Welcome to Mill City Hall. This is the Minneapolis Politics Podcast. You can find us on millcityhall.com for more episode notes and links. We also have a relatively new account on Instagram. Handle is Mill City Hall, where you can find clips to share. Try to share some clips in between episodes that are a little more bite-sized. I am Jesse Mortensen. We're recording in a new location, no longer my living room, no longer in Corcoran, just 7 blocks south on the Standish neighborhood. And we're upstairs in my new office slash studio, if I want to be pompous about it. Second bedroom, if I want to be less pompous about it. And I am joined by my co-hosts.
I'm Cam Gordon. Delighted to be here. Can't wait till you get the cameras so we can show everybody what a cool studio it is.
And I'm Robin Garwood. I live in St. Paul and used to work for Cam in City Hall.
So today we are kind of doing the election hangover episode. Not that I want to normalize drinking, but I think I do want to normalize thinking about our immediate election aftermath analysis as maybe not our most sober analysis. I'm always hesitant and skeptical of the really hot takes right after an election. I think things take a little bit of time. In our specific case in Minneapolis, we have some ballots still being tabulated in the ranked choice fashion, although the big one has been called and calculated for mayor by the time that we're recording this the morning after. I just think things need a little time to settle to like really dig in and get to some bigger lessons. But nonetheless, here we are. Everybody's going to be talking about it. We're going to talk about it too. So let's start just like at the, you know, the big picture. I'd love to hear kind of a gut reaction. You know, what's your mood? What's the big thing on your mind after yesterday's election?
Well, I think I've got some feelings about it. It's always rough, going in like the day before. I think you try to have expectations, you try to be realistic, you get high hopes, you get big fears. I think some of my fears have been realized. I'm particularly heartbroken, but not necessarily surprised about Ward 7 and that Katie Cashman lost. Also, I was really hoping that we might have a new mayor. I was really hoping that maybe we could make history and have our first black man as mayor of the city of Minneapolis ever, but we don't. And it's the sense we are still a tale of two cities. We are still having these big turnout, affluent white sections of the city deciding where we're going to go with our mayor. And we have four more years of Jacob Fry, which kind of from a podcaster or commentator point of view could be fun and interesting, and now we can keep that going. So I'm searching for silver lining, and there is some of it in there, and we're still definitely, this tale of two cities is going to be played out in our city council too, so we're going to see it there too, and the battle's going to kind of continue, and it'll be interesting to see where those council members kind of land and how they're able or unable to be independent and represent their wards or just go along with the team. So I'm in recovery mode.
Yeah, I'm feeling uniquely disappointed in my two cities, in Minneapolis and in St. Paul. It's a strange feeling, like when something bad has happened just to you. Your dog died, but it's a beautiful day. You know, it's like everything around you looks sunny and rosy and seems like everyone else is having a really good time. And you have this unique disappointment or sadness that maybe isn't broadly shared. You know, the national...
Vis-a-vis national, right?
Yeah. So the national news is all... great. I mean, the election results in Virginia and New Jersey, in New York City, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court elections, the redistricting in California. I mean, the Democrats and the left broadly ran the board yesterday everywhere except in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I'll maybe just note that. So we're mostly talking about Minneapolis politics, but I am also really disappointed in the St. Paul election results, where I think we elected a NIMBY friendly, you know, voice for the wealthy and powerful, and against things like non-motorized transportation, making it safer to walk and bike in my city. And then in Minneapolis, I was not necessarily expecting Jacob Frey to lose. I had hopes that we could get a new mayor. And those were not realized, and that's a big disappointment. We've got four more years of his, I think, toxic, divisive, crony nonsense in City Hall. The council moved not dramatically, but meaningfully, I think, to the right. And it will be harder, I think, for the progressives on the council to put the votes together for good things. The one bright spot is that the park board seems to have gotten significantly better, but that's digging pretty deep to find any silver lining. It's a mixed metaphor, but yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think for myself, I wouldn't call myself disappointed, but nor would I call myself appointed. Somewhere in the middle. These results locally feel kind of squarely in the frame of what we predicted a number of episodes ago, going back to the late spring. So, you know, it's in a way, you know, I looked at somebody posted once again, the, you know, like racial economic map of Minneapolis and compared that to the, you know, number one choice voting map of Minneapolis in this election. And once again, like there's a big overlap, right? So in a way, I take a step back and I think the sort of structural factors aren't that surprising. Like we're still a city that is deeply divided. There's sort of a, to your point, Cam, about the like white turnout districts, like that's still a major factor. And I think I saw a similar map about of St. Paul with a lot of overlap again of like, you know, where wealthier and whiter people live and where the like anti-Melvin Carter votes came from. And I don't know nearly as much about soon to be Mayor Herr's politics myself at all. So I don't comment there at all, but it is still, it feels like the fundamentals haven't shifted, even if the national fundamentals have shifted. You know, like there's a lot going on at the national level that is shifting how people are thinking and engaging with politics. And I think that's one of my big gut feelings so far is like something didn't shift really with the local races that maybe we were really hoping and people were working really hard to shift. So that's kind of how I'm feeling. Another thing I'm feeling is to get into the headline locally, the mayor's race. This feels like, I texted Robin on the way over here, this feels like a big vindication for things that you've been saying to me for several years now about what it takes to win the mayor in Minneapolis. We have not elected a mayor who's really much of a leftist at all in a long time. And we've had two elections now where there was pretty damning evidence that Jacob Frey is not doing a good job as a city council member, or sorry, as a mayor, I should say. And also this big like reactionary scare issue in the air, you know, like from 2020, from the pandemic, from the uprising. And we, the two elections in a row, the left has not found the recipe to knock this mayor out.
Three elections in a row.
Yeah, we'll say more about that, Rob. Say why you say three elections rather than two.
Well, so I think that there's now a clear pattern that what keeps helping Jacob Frey is that the left continues to fall in love with a candidate who is not poised to win the people who vote the most, who live in the Lakes area, who live in Southwest. So the last time we had a progressive mayor elected in Minneapolis, in my view, was back in 2013. huge crowded field, Betsy Hodges ended up winning. And part of how she ended up winning was she was broadly acceptable to the left. She had a big history with Take Action Minnesota and you know, the organizations that became Take Action Minnesota, like Progressive Minnesota back in the day. She had governed on the city council as one of our more progressive colleagues on a very conservative council at that time. And we didn't agree with her on every issue, but she was broadly sort of part of our team of like maybe five council members. And she ran for mayor as someone who was talking about closing that divide that you have been talking about, Jesse, between the two halves of the city, between the haves and the have nots. And you really explicitly made that like the theme of her campaign and of her time as mayor. And she was defeated in 2017, in part, at least, because the left gave up on her. The left was unhappy with her for very good reasons. And all got on board with Ray Dean, someone that then the left abandoned in his next try for re-election to the state legislature, interestingly. And then we did the same thing in 2021, where people could not meaningfully coalesce around Kate Knuth. And now we've done the same thing in 2025, where the folks on the left get really, really excited about somebody, and there isn't really a plan for like, how do we not just get the table run against us in Southwest Minneapolis in Ward 13? I mean, the numbers out of Ward 13 are like, they're crazy numbers. Lene Palmisano got 14,000 votes, which is more than several other city council winners combined. And that's the ward where I did the math just after the tabulations came out this morning. All of the challengers combined got something like 4,000 fewer votes than Jacob Fry in Ward 13. I mean, it's the place where if you want to elect a progressive mayor, you have to figure out how to actually get votes down there. And I never really thought that Omar Fateh was the candidate who could do that.
Yeah. And just a point of reference there, you know, 14,000 votes is almost 10% of the votes in the mayor's race. So yeah, if you think about that as a identity culturally somewhat homogenous block that may be expected to vote, you know, along a trend, right? Like, yeah, that's a huge chunk of votes to think about affecting the outcome.
Yeah, and actually, this was one of the reasons why some people were really disappointed that Emily Kosky didn't stay in the race, because she had already proven she had some appeal down there, which is a little bit what Betsy did. I mean, Betsy moved into the 13th ward and was able to get elected to the city council there. So she obviously was able to present a holistic enough or flexible enough approach to win enough votes. I don't remember who she ran against for council or all the details of it all.
Lisa McDonald.
Okay. So that was pretty. And so she definitely was running as a more progressive candidate. And Lisa has certain quirks about her too. So I could see why, you know, it's not always the politics. It's sort of the impression they get of people or the confidence in them. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I think Fry is so good, is because he can put on this persona that doesn't really reflect who he really is. But he has this look about him and all of these things that seems to appeal to people. And then RT was also from Southwest when he ran too. So that is definitely, and ran and won, a problem. And how to solve it, I'm not sure. But it was tough. I think this was a really ugly campaign too. And I think that Fry and all of the independent PACs that were spending money to support him had no reservations about blowing things up, especially going after Fateh, I think, over and over again about, and raising issues. And it was also negative on the other side too, because there was lots to be negative about with Fry. So that ended up, I think, just amplifying and fueling people who already made up their minds. And it didn't really end up pulling any votes very much. Yeah. It could easily have pulled some second choice votes off though, I think. And so it's interesting. We'll have to look at kind of the rounds, and we won't really necessarily know whose first choice was when they count the second choice. But I think there were probably some people who went with Davis or Hampton first, and then ended up doing Fry second, even because of the way the counting went down. And you look at those numbers, they didn't all go to Fate. And so there was work for some people, I think. And it might have been a good strategy. But if we can't get away somehow from these independent expenditures pouring all this money in from just a limited number of really wealthy people, I think that it's going to be harder and harder to have a real democracy. I will kind of admit, though, that I think what we ended up with kind of reflects the actual city. And that's often what I just assume democracy does, because this is really the way who showed up and how they voted. And look at this. We're still like this. Ew. Although in some parts we were very strong. There was money poured into opposition on council members, just dumped in there. And they recruited candidates and tried to build them up, all of this. And they still lost to more progressive incumbents. So that was good.
Yeah, to your point, Cam, the flow chart that the city puts out about about where the votes went from each of the candidates who was dropped is very helpful in terms of just visualizing the amount of support that went from people who ranked Davis and Hampton first to Fate versus Fry. And in order to overcome the deficit that he had, Fate needed to pick up something like 75% of second choice votes. And he got something like 48%, which is more than Fry, but Fry got like 31%. So there were a meaningful number of people who went in and voted for somebody who wasn't Jacob Fry and then said, yeah, but I'm more comfortable with him than I am with Omar Fate. The interesting dynamic of this, like if you look at the numbers from 2021, the people who went in and voted for Sheila Najad as their first choice, 83% of those people voted for Kate Knuth as their second. The people who voted for Kate Knuth, 65% of them ranked Sheila Najad second, the next meaningful ranking, the next place where their vote would count for Sheila. And that, I think, kind of should be instructive that, like, if we want to have a meaningful coalition between what you might call the center left and the left of Minneapolis politics, it only works when the center left person comes in at least second. It doesn't work if they come in third or fourth or fifth. Because then you're left with this situation where a bunch of people go in and they say, I am not ready for Jacob Fry to be mayor with my strong support anymore. I would like to try somebody else, but that person on the far left scares me and I don't want to vote for them and I'm not going to. I think that the folks to the left of Jacob Fry have to kind of take that seriously. Like, we have to have a strategy for that. We have to have some kind of plan for winning people over.
I want to note for the record, for our listeners, that Robin Garwood has been hammering on this, at least privately. I'm sure he's been talking to other people. He's been bending my ear about this central premise for years at this point. And I've never really wanted to fully buy in because it's a little bit more pessimistic than my brain wants to be. But I have to say, I think Robin's pretty right. I think he had this called roughly a year ago. It looks very much like the results he predicted in our private conversations. I don't know how much got on the podcast. And at this point, I have to agree with that central premise that we've got to cope with this hard limit. Like I think of Omar Fate as having done about as good as like a true deep progressive left candidate can do. He had a ton of endorsements from multiple levels. He had the bona fides to say, hey, you know, I'm not just a hardcore commie or whatever, right? Like, look at all these people around the political spectrum who are my coworkers, my peers, who are endorsing me. Had a bunch of organizational endorsements. Everybody seems to like him, right? Like, it's, you know, I haven't been around him a ton myself personally, but I hear good things, right? So it's not like, you know, you could say, well, there's some negatives. He's, you know, he's associated or adjacent to these kind of fraud cases. It wasn't ever pinned on him. He was cleared, but like, there's enough in the air where that could have been used as a negative.
There was stuff pinned, though. I mean, there were ethics complaints in the legislature, and he had to pay money back for getting a free office, and he did some stuff. So before he was ever running. So I don't just think it's whether or not you're far left. I think it's how well you can appeal to the more cautious, I don't know what to call those voters, because it's even without politics. So I talked to some big supporters of mine who didn't mind his progressive positions and policies and what he'd gotten passed. And this was older woman, but always a diehard, really big progressive anti-war protester out there against the king, you know, no more kings and all of that stuff. But it's like, I'm just not sure about him. Is he going to, whereas Davis seemed like honest, trustworthy, and to all the way, and she was a huge supporter of his. So, in fact, she wanted to talk to me because she wanted me to help her get around how to rate the three and not drop one off. And it was Vate that she was concerned about dropping off. So it's hard to know, but sometimes I think it's more than how far left you are. Mm-hmm. There's different characteristics that we need. And some people will even forgive somebody for not being clear and far enough on an issue. So I'm sure Davis got ranked first by people who do want rent stabilization, you know, and those other kinds of things, because they were saying, okay, well, we can work on that. But
yeah, I mean, I hear you, Cam. And I think we can imagine a candidate who maybe has more of like a generational charisma or like brought a personal story that like really connected with the moment in a unique way.
We got
way.
A guy in New York who I think.
Right. And we could imagine that. and we could say, well, maybe that person with the exact same, you know, sort of policy positioning would do better. Like, maybe that person could win. But we also, you know, like, do you really want to organize your political strategy around finding that person? Like, hey, bully for you if you can, but, you know, looking for the outlier to save you from a sort of recurring structural constraint might not be the smartest strategy going forward.
No, you got to recruit good candidates, I guess, and vet them and try, and it would be to find people who are going to be strong enough to do it. But there's other strategies that we've got to use as well. And how do we, you know, what do we do about this Fertile Crescent of where all these voters are coming from? I'm also not sure how the running as a slate worked. So that's something to think about, because there was obviously an idea a lot of people had is let's run together, let's support each other, and we'll go forward. I even think Jazz at the beginning was willing to run that as sympathetic towards Jacob. I mean, I seem to remember seeing him with a Jacob button on, and he had all the candidates' buttons. And so that's something that I don't have an answer to or anything, but it's interesting if maybe it would have been different if they had been more separate sometimes. And it's same with their independent expenditure pack. It decided to be, we're going to do independent expenditures for all three. And did that make sense? That isn't what the other PACs were doing. They were picking Jacob and they were spending money independently to support him. But I don't have an answer to those things, but those are questions and stuff to think about.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm not sure that we need to look to Zoran Mamdani in New York City to find someone who has some of the characteristics that could have won in Minneapolis. I think we had that person in Duane Davis. I think that. So the question for me is, like, how can the sort of broad left of Jacob Frey group of folks in Minneapolis latch on to someone like a Duane Davis and make that decision in a strategic way in the future rather than gravitating towards somebody who I just, you know, it's like the moment that Omar Fateh got in the race, I thought, why is he doing that? How is he going to win where all the votes are? Like, I couldn't see it happening. I couldn't see it working. And I could really see Dwayne Davis doing better down there. If he had come in second, I think he might have come in first. I think there might have been a greater crossover vote for him from the other two challengers. So running as a slate makes some sense. It's a way that you can beat an incumbent who has the votes to come in first, but doesn't have necessarily a plurality of the vote. A majority of the vote, excuse me. Like, it happened in Ward 4 back in 2017. I mean, there was a little bit of a coalition between candidates who were ideologically aligned against Barb Johnson. Mm-hmm. It can work. It worked in New York City in the primary with Brad Lander getting on Tsaron Mamdani's side and them saying we're cross endorsing each other. So it can work. It has to be somehow in aid of the person who can win. And I don't know how you do that.
One thing that did not match my predictions about this race is early on, I think I was similar to you. My gut was like, I think Dwayne Davis has a chance to do really well. However, Dwayne Davis seemed really good guy. Seems like folks worked hard. But my view, my first kind of reaction after Election Day here is that throughout the campaign, that campaign underperformed versus my own predictions, expectations. And I'm very curious to dig into, I don't know if we have all the answers today, but to dig into why was that? I would have expected, like, based on who Dwayne Davis is, the kind of bearing he brings to public spaces, to speaking, the thoughtfulness that we saw from his actions throughout the campaign, I would have thought he would have eaten a lot more of, like, Jazz Hampton's votes. I thought he would have eaten some of Jacob Frey's votes. But there's a two hard constraints that I see in these numbers from yesterday. One is that Jacob Frey's number one votes hardly changed at all. I mean, it's within like hundreds or something. Like, he didn't lose any number one voters in absolute or percentage terms compared to 4 years ago. And the overall number of voters didn't really change in a huge way. So if you can't either somehow depress or sway some of an incumbent's number one votes, and you can't bring in a whole new constituency in some kind of wave, how are you going to beat an incumbent? I really thought that Dwayne Davis, with his positioning, could pull some Jacob Frey voters, and it seems like he didn't. Obviously, like, raw aggregates are not individual people. Like, I'm sure there were some individual people, but in aggregate, it seems like he didn't. And I don't have a good internal guess as to why it is that he underperformed in that way. Versus my own expectations and predictions.
I'll just have to say that Frey and Fateh had a head start. They'd already run for office. They were already popular. They'd already been elected. A lot of people knew about them and were excited about them. And so that put a big handicap on any kind of newcomer that came in. And I think that had a lot to do with it. I think if the DFL endorsement process had gotten Davis an endorsement or something, that could have been a big boost to that. And we have to remember that whole thing was a really big mess too. And there was a whole lot of mudslinging over all of that to say, you know, it doesn't even count and it doesn't matter. And that was kind of a disaster too. But
yeah, I think that's a really important point. I don't think that we can understate how the fucked up convention and the subsequent, like, rat fucking of it by especially the Frey camp impacted things.
Yeah. But I don't know. I do think probably the Davis campaign, you could say, underperformed. I know he had a death in the family and he even took a break for a while. And then was trying to pick up speed and getting momentum. And I guess timing's really important. Momentum's really important. And he didn't have it going into the convention, and it wasn't happening going into the election either, I guess. And I don't really have a reason. I'd say if he maybe had been elected to office before, if he'd had more exposure, more track record, was more well known, that would have been a really big boost. So people could think about that for next time. And I think some people are. I think even maybe one person who got elected this time is thinking about it for next time. And he decided.
Oh, that's a tease. Who's that? Are we not revealing?
Jameson. Yeah. I think Jameson is feels charismatic. I think he has a big, strong ego. I think he easily won in Southwest, easily. And I don't really haven't talked to him. He hasn't said anything about it. But I could see that as being an instance of. If I can be successful here and I can prove myself on the council, and we could segue into these council races, but I think it will really be interesting to see where Jameson lands in the divide, too, because he's stayed pretty safe and he's been careful to be pleasing both sides a little bit. You know what I mean? So I don't know. That's a thought.
I'll just say to your point, Jesse, I think Jacob came into this election with some strengths. He has a base that is relatively committed to him, whether they really like him specifically or not, or whether that's out of fear of some other. I'm not as clear about, but he also came in with some very real weaknesses. He doesn't tend to crack 40% very much in terms of his first choice votes. Which means that a super majority of Minneapolis voters are ready to vote for someone other than him.
Yep.
In every election he's ever run in citywide. And so the question that I am continuing to grapple with is how can that 60% of folks meaningfully coalesce around someone who can actually put those 60% of votes into one group behind one candidate who can beat Jacob Frey. I think the people of Minneapolis have been ready for Jacob Frey to go away for some time now. It's just that the way that his opposition continues to put forward alternatives it happens in such a way that it benefits him just over and over and over again. And I think part of that, part of the answer to the question that I think you're asking about, like, why did the Dewayne Davis campaign underperform? Part of that is because he didn't have the group of excited, passionate people glom onto his campaign. They glommed onto Omar Fateh's campaign instead.
Yeah. And this is part of your premise, as I've understood it for a few years, which is like the left needs to in advance decide we're going to support a more moderate looking candidate rather than we're going to start in the camp of somebody like a Fateh, a Najad, a Ray Dean. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah.
What's your pitch, Robin? Give us the 10 seconds.
Yeah. It's like, mostly it's like have a plan, have some sort of idea how the candidate that you are supporting the most is going to crack into the big bucket of votes that are down in Southwest Minneapolis. And if your answer to that is we're going to swamp them with a bunch of new voters from somewhere, no, you're not. We've tried it over and over again. It's not going to happen. If the answer is the magic of RCV is just going to sort of like solve it for us, we'll run as a big slate. It's like, no, it's not. It doesn't work like that. So, having some sort of strategic thinking prior to the campaign to think like, yeah, I might be excited about this person, but can he or she meaningfully compete down in Southwest? And if the answer to that question is no, then say, okay, I'm going to maybe like eat my own excitement a little bit and go work my heart out for somebody that isn't someone that I am completely in love with. It's kind of like the old thing that they used to say about how Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line, which I don't think is actually true anymore. I think the Republicans are about as besotted with Donald Trump as you could possibly get. But like, I think there is some truth to that in terms of the sort of left-right divide in Minneapolis. The right-leaning voters, activists, money, whatever, fall in line behind their sometimes parachuted in ridiculous candidates who don't even live in the ward that they're aiming to serve, like Shelley Medore. Yeah. And meanwhile, the left kind of lurches from one new passionate affair to another.
Slight quibble. I mean, Omar Fateh was, you know, established name, elected official, had a good rep at the Capitol.
Had an okay
rep. Somewhat rational choice.
Had an okay rep at the Capitol. I mean, I think the way that the whole rideshare thing went down left a lot of bad blood that hasn't really gotten talked about super openly. I think that there are folks who think the Democratic trifecta was not able to get a bunch of big things that were really, really important over the finish line because they had to spend so much time on the rideshare law, just kind of spinning their wheels and getting back to the place where Jacob Frey and the rideshare companies were in the beginning. So I think there are some sour grapes about one of his really essentially like biggest legislative pushes.
I just see it slightly different than Robin, because I don't really know that we should blame or think that it's the fault of an organized left out there. And this is probably because I ran for office and was an elected official. I think it's their job to figure it out. I think if Fateh really had wanted to win, he should have at the very early stages said, how do I reframe or how do I position myself so I can actually appeal to and prove that I will represent these voters who I don't always agree with? I mean, and that is a big trick and it's a big challenge, but almost he should have spent all that time not necessarily door knocking with other people in 6 and 9 and 2, but going out in 11 and 13, figuring out who he could get from those neighborhoods to have house parties and be there. And I think that's a big challenge and it's probably really hard, but I did get the impression that he and his campaign weren't necessarily focused on that. They were focused on kind of saying, I don't care about you guys. I care about, you know, the workers or whatever, drawing dividing lines. And Jacob does the exact same thing, but he draws his dividing lines so that he's drawing them, showing that he'll support where the high voter turnout is. And I think that's how he wins, and that's the trick. And what's going to be really sad, even though he never gets a majority of first choice votes, so he can see over half of the city doesn't have confidence in him, doesn't feel represented by him, but he's not going to care. He's going to just say, I've still got my group and my base that do. They voted for me. They're going to get all the stuff. And that's the most depressing thing about selection, that they're going to have more of that. Yeah. Thank goodness we have a council that doesn't go along with everything he says.
Yeah.
Just a quick note on the numbers geographically. I think it's interesting to look at where Frey and where Fateh came in first by ward. Fateh won 5 wards of the city. He won ward 2. So the area around the University of Minnesota, he won Ward 6, which is the East African Opportunity Ward centered in Cedar Riverside. He won Ward 8 by only 200 votes. He won Ward 9 and Ward 10 by a more substantial margin. And Jacob won everywhere else. And he ran up really huge numbers in Southwest. He beat Fateh by 8,000 plus votes in Ward 13, 4,000 plus votes in Ward 11, but he also racked up some pretty big numbers in on the north side. He won by over 1,000 votes in Ward 4, and then of course he won Ward 7. And then just like for giggles, I actually put up the total of all 3 of the challengers, the 3 major challengers against Frey, to see where Frey beat all of them. And he beat all of them in a few wards. He beat all of them in Ward 13. He beat all of them in Ward 11. He beat all of them in Ward 7, and he beat all of them in Ward 3.
Those are the wards you need to win to become an at-large representative.
That's Jacob Frey's base.
Yep.
And so I think none of them meaningfully chipped into that base.
12 has interestingly changed a bit. Because 12 used to be a pretty much clear. In fact, that was the last Republican ward before Sandy Covenroy became the first Democrat, I think, to win it. But interesting.
And I think Ward 12 is actually a really interesting example of this, because all three of the challengers together beat Jacob by almost 3,000 votes in Ward 12. But the head-to-head between Jacob and Omar Fateh was 2,700 votes in Jacob's favor. So there were a lot of Davis Hampton type voters in Ward 12. And a lot of those folks, I think, did not become Fateh voters.
There's a lot more to dig into around the mayor's race, but let's segue into city council. I think we've got some good thoughts on the table for us to be thinking about. Before we do, just one quick note. I've seen a number of comments online about ranked choice voting, and did ranked choice voting, is that a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Did it somehow screw this race up? And I just want to ask, like, do either of you think that there would be a different outcome if this was a conventional municipal primary in September, municipal general with two candidates in November?
No. I think what would have happened in September is Jacob would have come in first, Omar would have come in second, and it would have been between those two. And I think we would have seen a very similar result in November. One of the things that I think we always have to point out about the municipal primaries is that they happen at a time when the college students who live in the area around the University of Minnesota literally can't vote because they haven't lived there long enough. So it not only disenfranchises people just by being a low turnout municipal primary that tends to have, you know, an older, wealthier, whiter, more conservative skew, but there are some people who are structurally left out. So no, I don't think this is the fault of ranked choice voting. I think the old system would have produced the same results. I think in 2021, it would have produced the same results.
I can't really argue with that. I think it probably would have been pretty similar. It would have got down to the top two, and it probably would have been the same top two as in round one. And then there would have been a big battle and more negative campaigning. And if the wards, as Robin outlaid, that high voter turnout voted for Frye, he would have won.
There is maybe some argument that something else like consensus voting might have
approval voting. Yeah. Like the check everyone you approve of.
Right.
Method.
That may have produced a different result. I think you might have seen a Davis be the most, you know, the person with the greatest consensus around his candidacy. One of the factors of ranked choice voting is that it basically takes intensity into account. So it doesn't just matter that someone has your support. It matters how strongly you feel about that support. You can look at it both ways. That could be both a bug and a feature. In a case like this, what ends up happening is you have, you know, it really matters that there are a lot of votes for Dwayne Davis and Jazz Hampton in, you know, under Omar Fateh that no one is ever going to look at.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think for me, it's sort of, I think for some people, I worry a little bit that the RCV angle is just kind of covering for those more fundamental problems of like, how do you get a winning coalition together that we just talked about in the previous conversation. So to me, like, I look at this election so far and I'm like, well, let's not hang, you know, to hang this on RCV feels like a mistake. It feels like we're kind of just shifting it because it's easier maybe to blame something other than like kind of our own political investments and our own, you know, strategic choices.
I think it points, or not RCV, but I think this election points to a bigger problem that we have in our structure and our system. And that's when we think it's smart or wise somehow to give a concentration of power to somebody who's elected at large in the city of Minneapolis. It automatically is a given that it disenfranchises thousands and thousands of people. I mean, you can just see that in the numbers where Fry didn't even come in and do that. And so I think we should even think about how do we pick a mayor and do we need a mayor? And do we certainly need a strong mayor like we have now? And who decided we needed a strong mayor? Look back at the numbers on that. The same people who are supporting and voting for Fry. And this is a wealthy group that seem to like the concentration of power in the hands of a few that stretch across that west, you know, curving part of the city into the third ward. And it's just a big problem.
Amen, Cam. Minneapolis Commune 2029. I think we're starting that campaign right here, right now.
One last thing on the RCV thing. I think part of what you're seeing is there's a certain amount of magical thinking about RCV that, like, it is going to magically build our coalitions for us, and we don't have to do the hard work of making sound strategic decisions and figuring out, to your point, Cam, how to actually go talk to the people that I think the left has broadly kind of written off who live down in Southwest Minneapolis. To your point, exactly the same way that Jacob Fry has written off big chunks of South Central Minneapolis. RCV doesn't do that. And blaming it for not doing a thing that it doesn't do is just kind of silly. It's not a flying car. It's just a regular old car that drives on the ground, and that's what it's going to do. And if you're mad that it didn't fly, your expectations were maybe a little bit skewed.
There, nobody could even decide to challenge Lene. I mean, Bob Carney did, but not a serious candidate there. Right. And there are some very big progressives in Southwest, and they've got their Southwest equity.
Southwest Alliance for Equity.
Thank you.
Equity.
good job. And others. But it's disappointing that we're stuck so much down there.
All right. Let's talk about the city council. And I think we're all united in our biggest disappointment there is the loss of Katie Cashman in Ward 7. Speaking of big money and people who are really sort of like locked in to support the more conservative side of the political spectrum. I just want to say, I really hope that, and this is to me like a big caveat, like I wanted to say about everybody who put their personal time and money and energy into trying to make this city better through these elections. Like, I really appreciate everybody who did that. And whether we say, well, you know, oh, I think maybe this campaign made a strategic mistake or not. Like, I never want to denigrate the work that people put in, largely on the progressive side, largely as volunteers, right? Because there was way less money available to pay anybody on that side of it. Right. So, but especially like Katie Cashman, I think really, campaign hard and ran a good campaign, and folks around her were supporting somebody who I thought was a pretty dang good for somebody from Ward 7. So it's really a bummer that to see Elizabeth Schaefer edge her out there.
Yeah, not only a good candidate, a good council member.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a loss for the city as a whole. And I admit it was so exciting when somebody who actually cared about the environment won that seat, somebody who's younger. I think we should maybe look at the ages too in this. There seems to be some ageism going on and who gets elected and who gets votes. But she was powerful. It was kind of lucky last election because her opponent was so
terrible.
Bad. Yeah, it wasn't very good. So it was fortunate. But then she proved herself, I think, to be a great representative and to be able to make progress and make changes. And then the forces that be just decided to pigeonhole her and others on one side. And she, I don't think, ever was necessarily like that. I think she was reflecting a lot of people in her ward and doing a good job. She also happened to be interested in fighting climate change and zero waste, things that I care about a lot. So I saw that as, oh, I can, and now I have somebody on the council that I could even reach out to who isn't my representative, but because they support the issues that I care most about. So I did get this vested interest in that. And I'm not sure what Elizabeth Schaefer is going to champion either. It seems like it's just a really kind of a safe status quo, going to be careful to govern and make sure that services are provided kind of a council member. And I don't know, that could have benefits to the city as a whole, but it's not going to be the same.
It is. I think I've seen this in a couple of different places. I think Wedge Live maybe said something like this. If you look at the way that Katie Cashman has actually governed, she is exactly the kind of city council member folks over there describe wanting. She did really pretty much exactly the things that they are asking folks to do, both and in terms of her policy on policing, skeptical of rent stabilization. I mean, just on issue after issue, she was aligned with them, and that didn't matter. They painted her as like a mini Robin Wansley. They painted her as some DSA radical, which she wasn't.
Holding up, some idiot holding up, you know, DSA signs at the Ward 7 convention to paint her. Yeah, which is just, it's just very dirty politics. It's deranged if it's sincere, and it's very dirty if it's insincere.
Yeah, dishonest. And am I surprised that that happened, having knocked doors in Ward 7? I'm not surprised that that happened. But it is very disappointing.
Another district where we had said, hey, this is an important swing district, District 5, Ward 5. Have we seen final decision in there?
Yes,
I have not seen the news.
Pearl Warren.
Oh.
One. Yeah. So.
Too bad.
And she is the Fry aligned, all of Minneapolis, we love Minneapolis candidate up there. She beat out Atrophic Burnett. So. Five has now moved also into the more right-leaning column. Will Pearl Warren be as like reflexively and almost like rabidly conservative as Latricia Vital? Like, who knows? But that's the alignment. She's moved. Ward Five has moved over there. And that's after a good solid, what, two terms for Jeremiah Allison, holding it down as a very progressive North Side city council member. It's a real pity. So the overall makeup of the council, I think, has moved to the right, not hugely, because Soren Stevenson also won in Ward 8. And that was also not a surprising outcome. But he will be replacing Andrea Jenkins, who was more kind of aligned with the conservative side of the council. But yeah, one pickup for the left, two pickups for the right. And then wards 6 and 11, in the one, because Jamal Osman, the Ward 6 city council member, won re-election, but he's kind of always been a swing vote, and I think
and he did explicitly say, "I'm the swing vote at the election night party." And yeah. No more Fateh's election night. So it says they're right there on the tin.
Yeah, had Fateh won, I think he might have been pulled more to the left by his alliance with Fateh. But the fact that Jacob Fry won re-election, I think, puts him back in Swingville. And then, especially early on, the Ward 11 city council member, remind me of her name, Cam.
Emily Kosky.
Emily Kosky, was a swing vote on the council, even maybe a Fry aligned vote at the beginning, and is going to be replaced by another swing type person.
So just to do the overview, what we're looking at is 5 moderates, 6 progressives, and 2 swing votes. So that's a swing city council. We had in our earlier episode predicted a sort of a range, a framing of like, well, there's the most conservative scenario where moderates get 7 votes, and the most progressive scenario where progressives get 8 votes. And we have ended up in between those two. So not a big surprise. I don't know that any of these elections are that surprising for city council.
No, it's pretty much probably what we would have predicted. I do think that maybe Osman will be pushed over, because I think the way Jacob operates, if you're not on his team, you're not on his team. And so he's probably not going to want to cooperate much with Jamal. And so Jamal, I think, is going to feel maybe more comfortable where he kind of was landing near the end of the term. And I don't know what had ruffled the feathers to make him land there, but he did land more in the group, you know, with the council president and vice president and that. Of course, that's a thing that we can all be wondering about now, especially those of us who've been on the inside of it all. How are they having discussions about the next council president? And does Elliot Payne have it still set up that he has the votes needed? And how are they going to set up the committees? That will be interesting to see if there's, when we probably won't even hear about the controversy. A lot of that happens in meetings outside of City Hall when there's discussions, but something to think about. And I also am curious to see where we're going to see how Jameson lands. And I think he's going to have to represent his constituents, and he probably wants to get reelected. So he's going to have to be careful. He'll probably stay pretty much playing middle ground and being careful, much as Katie and Emily, I think, did when they were first elected. And hopefully we won't have another one of this where the outside world has to make sure that there's two teams and demonize one half or whatever and not the other.
It seems like it's going to be a pretty difficult council just in terms of figuring out how to get along, figuring out how to actually pass things. I mean, the council president vote will be one of those good first tests to see how the swing voters are coming down, you know, on the sides, or to see if there's some way to actually like attempt to build some sort of a functional single unit. It reminds me of like the pre-2013 city council that you and I were on, where there were a lot of folks just sort of in the middle, and it was super strangely like it could go any way, you know. It was like on a given day, people could kind of lurch from one position to another.
We got to get to know Jameson Whiting. We got to get to know a little better Jamal Osman, because these two votes are going to have a big influence in the outcome. I was also struck, you know, Cam, you mentioned earlier that we had some wards where a ton of money was poured in, and luckily that money did not secure its intended outcome. Really happy that Aisha Chugtai was reelected. I'm really happy that Soren Stevenson got through. Yeah, I mean, there definitely are victories here, even as we say the council has moved a notch to the right. And I like the leadership of Council President Payne, Vice President Chugtai. Like, I think these are good leaders for this city. I put stock in these folks, and I really hope that they can, you know, I wish them luck in the negotiations to try to secure, you know, another few years in these spots of leadership on the council.
The one other one that you didn't list where a huge amount of money came in was Ward 2, Robin. Yep. Wansley. They really came for her too. They were able to notch up two wins for all of the money that funneled through the all of Minneapolis and various other Jacob Frey aligned fire hoses. One of them was the easiest kind of pickup opportunity where the incumbent isn't running again in Ward 5. And then they were able to pick off Katie Cashman, who they was not really to the left of her ward, I don't think, but they were able to sort of smear her as being to the left of her ward.
And which, it's a ward with a lot of highly motivated rich people.
Yeah. And it's in a certain sense, it is a reversion to mean. It's the ward that elected Lisa Goodman time after time after time, which is a little bit like what we saw a few elections ago, where Ward 4 went from, you know, someone very narrowly beating Barb Johnson, who had been in there for decades, to, you know, that person only getting a single term and being replaced by someone who is aligned with Barb. So there is a little bit of this reversion to mean stuff happening all over the place. But yeah, it really shows the limitations on how much that money matters when you're trying to oust a progressive from a progressive ward.
I think people might also think in the future, especially if they want to manipulate things more, about that DFL endorsement too, because there was no endorsement in 10. So that didn't have the DFL candidate, and Chuck Dye held on. There was an endorsement in 7 of Schaefer, kind of surprisingly, and it looked like there were shenanigans almost that froze the floor and those kind of things to get that. But that, I worry that that could have made some people say, oh, she's DFL endorsed and she's going to be okay, and without looking very far into it. Same thing in 2. You know, Wansley didn't compete for the endorsement, but it got blocked, and so Shelley didn't have it, and I think that was interesting. But I think it is a powerful statement that the one non-DFL independent was able to hold a seat, and we still have that on the council.
The legacy of the third party independent candidate is alive in Ward 2.
Yes, it is. I'll also note that it'll be interesting about the not only the vice president and the president. One thing I noticed about when Payne became president was it looked like that progressive group just wanted to hold on and not make sure to make a compromise with the vice president. Councils in the past have tried to do an olive branch reach out and say, okay, we're going to try to get more of a kumbaya 13 vote, and we're going to give away the vice presidency to somebody on the other side. Glidden became vice president to kind of help balance that out. If I don't know whether that would be good or bad or not, but there might be some giving on that progressive side that could help. And another thing
Jamal
is about
Osmond,
who gets to chair which committees. So there'll be some people who want to chair a committee, and that could be a big opportunity for them. And they might do a good job running the meeting. I don't know that Rainville should do it, be the one they pick. But anyway, that would be something to see too. Are they willing to try to get more united? And I'll just add one more thing that gives me a little bit of hope is, even though they're hiring outside people to do it and spending millions of dollars, but they have something in place now that says they're going to go through a strategic planning and visioning statement, and then even some training for the council. But I think what's been missing, and Jacob has never wanted to do since he was mayor, is some kind of a let's get together and have some time to get to know each other and our priorities and agree on a set of priorities or big goals. I don't know if you've noticed this, Robin, but the vision statement on the city website and their strategic goals and values are the ones we basically wrote with Philippe. I don't know how you remember the story, but that's what I kind of have in my head. A few of us ended up haggling over it, and they're still there and not being followed at the time. So I think that would be really good if this new council and mayor had to sit in a room together and try to come to some kind of consensus on some broad goals or values. And I also would love to be a fly on the wall and watch it.
That is not Jacob Fry's style, man. Pigs fly, I don't think it's going to happen.
Let's talk about some of these other bodies that we had the elections for yesterday. The Park Board.
Park Board flipped in a major way towards a more progressive direction. It's the one silver lining, as I said earlier. I think that this new board could have either 5 or 6 out of 9 be more sort of progressive aligned. And that's a big change from basically this old board was like 7 relatively conservative folks and 2 progressive outliers, Becky Alper and Tom Olson. Does depend on what happens in that at-large election, but it seems, looking at the numbers, like Meg Forney is going to be reelected, Tom Olson's going to be reelected, and then the 3 biggest vote getters of the rest of the field, who are the only 3 that I think could conceivably win, all 3 of them are to the left of anybody on the Park Board right now, except, you know, Tom and Becky. But then, yeah, in District 1, Dan Englehart won. In District 3, Becky Alpers being replaced by somebody who didn't have any opponent, but it seems like she feels like he's going to do an okay job.
I think so. I live in that district and didn't even get any campaign lid from him dropped off or anything. So I don't know all that much about his positions, but he seems to be fairly similar to Becky from one article I wrote about the race. But
Stephanie Musich has lost in the
music has ended.
Yeah. In the district.
Music has ended.
It hasn't happened formally yet, but if you look at the numbers, I don't think there's any way that Musich can hang on.
That's a big upset kind of, and yes. I think that's a big shift. And that was clearly a younger Kay was chosen and probably recruited. It looked like supported by the council members in the area, and kind of a surprise. But I will say about the whole park board thing, I think that labor dispute and the strike, it really got people motivated and activated to run and to run hard and to pay attention to that campaign. And it's made a difference, even if the two incumbents, Tom and Tom was more on the worker side when the strike was going on, and Meg got reelected. I mean, they're incumbents. Meg's actually pretty popular out there. I'm a little worried about the other more conservative district out there. Colby, I think is her name. Colby. I'm not sure where that's going to land, or if we've figured out who's going to represent that area. Jason Garcia.
Yep, Jason Garcia.
I think
in District 4.
Yeah, is doing really well and might take it.
I think he's going to win. Yeah.
But that's...
So of the current folks on the park board who were on the wrong side of both the labor dispute, and I also think that the Uptown Mall vote to retain all of that parking and give back a bunch of free money to make it.
Yeah. Wasn't that Elizabeth Schaefer's idea?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Of all of those folks, I think only three of them are coming back. Rucker, who is moving from at large to the seat that Becca Thompson is currently in up on the north side, and then Kathy Abeen.
Yeah.
So that's a big change, and could maybe actually bode well for that institution kind of working, at least for a while.
Which has been pretty dysfunctional.
For a long time.
It could be great.
Yeah.
Could be great. We'll cross our fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to see if they decide they need to do a search for their attorney. I think a lot of concern about the park board has been that the staff has controlled a lot, and that's Brian Rice, and his firm has a big contract with the park board, and then even the superintendent, and how much, and that's always a struggle with electeds, how much do they follow the bureaucracy and the leaders of their experts, but I think the last park board was happy to go along with everything, and that's what got them in a lot of trouble with the strike and the workers too.
And then there's the Board of Estimate and Taxation, where I was pretty shocked to see that Eric, the younger guy, actually got the most first choice votes.
He did some creative campaigning.
Yeah.
Handsome dude too.
Yeah.
Doesn't hurt.
And then Steve Brandt.
That's a matter of opinion.
Well, of course.
And then Steve Brandt came in second, but both of them well ahead of Bob Fine. Which means I think we have a relatively good chance of having at least a non-problematic, if not kind of a cool activist Board of Estimate and Taxation.
Yeah, I think that was probably a good result there. And I do think that Steve is fairly handsome himself. Just wanted to get that in there. And Bob, he's probably okay looking too.
Steve Brandt, Silver Fox.
But... they are. I actually see the two winners as more activist and might be willing to maybe take on more because also who sits on that board, but the mayor and the council president.
Yeah.
And park board representative. We'll see who that is. But yeah, that will be interesting to see. I think they're creative and energetic. And I thought that both Steve and Eric ran really active and hard campaigns. Yeah. And were out there all the time. And that somebody who wanted it is bad as they do probably deserve to be there and to take it on, and I seem knowledgeable too. We'll see.
Yeah, I agree that Steve was running. I saw him at a bunch of stuff, just random, just old Steve, you know, at public stuff, you know, working hard all year. Eric was on social media doing interesting stuff. I think he did. He was like for a Board of Estimate Taxation candidate, like brought a lot more more flair and accessibility, especially to like I think younger people who are never thinking about this board to the campaign. Which I
wasn't
appreciated.
Somebody making benches to put up around the public. Eric. Yeah,
it will be useful to have a lot of other more progressive folks on the BET to rein in some of Jacob's worst impulses. I think. I think if he was entirely in charge of budgeting issues, it would be a lot worse. And specifically, I think it would be a lot worse for a progressive park board. So I could see there being a big alliance between the park folks who just got elected and these BET folks and a council president to make sure that they don't face cuts. So that we can give all the money to cops or whatever.
So a pretty good result for the BET. And that brings us to the end of our overview and gut reactions. Let's get to any last notes we want to just kind of like get out of our head before we call this one, this election hangover episode to a close. I, for one, I would just like to say, you know, there's always, for me, it's like you got to savor the chances to say good riddance to someone who campaigned in a really bad way, you know, and then the voters actually, you know, somewhat recognized and defeated that person. So I want to say good riddance to a few people. Good riddance to Becca Thompson for her racist ass comments. Get out of here. Don't come back. I want to say good riddance to Shelley Madore for all, and her cadre of supporters for her. They're like, very silly, narrow-minded attempt to exclude a bunch of students especially, but like people in the DSA, like get over yourselves. There is no coherent DFL party. Like stop with that, you know, stop using that bullshit. Ward 2, as we know in this room, has a long tradition of having candidates who are not strictly DFL up and down. That's a good thing. That's a good thing for the city. So good riddance to Shelley Madore. I also want to say good riddance to Josh Bisai. I saw late in the campaign, I can't remember if it was literally his campaign or if it was independent, but there was a mailer that was out there saying, oh, Soren Stevenson, he just got here. Josh Bisai was born and raised here. Good riddance to that bullshit. We don't need that. That's not helping the city at all. Like, for Christ's sake, the guy's got his eye shot out by the police. Like, and you know what? This is a city of this is a cosmopolitan, diverse city, a city of renters. People move around, you know, like, look, let's judge people on the merits of their convictions, the merits of their work and experience and what they bring to the race. I don't want to see that tired trope in future campaigns.
Yeah, I would add good riddance to Lydia Millard and putting yourself on bikes on your campaign lit when you're saying anti-bike stuff at forums earlier in the year. I'd also like to say good riddance to some of the retiring city council members. I think it is a good thing for the city of Minneapolis that Andrea Jenkins will no longer be on the city council. And having worked with her for years and liked and respected her, I don't think that her time on the city council was particularly great for the city. Yeah.
I would like to chime in and just say that I was very excited to see Soren win. And I also want to just mention that there's probably a lot of candidates out there who are feeling pretty bad today. And I think that we should thank them for being willing to step up and run. We can't have democracy if people don't run. We don't have choices if people don't run. We can't talk about the issues and we can't do that. So thank you for running. And if you need look no further than Soren to see that you can lose and run again and win. That happens. This could be the start of a journey out there. People worked really, really hard for a lot of these races and were out there constantly, gave up a lot for their families, for their friends, spent a lot of their own money, I'm sure, and then they didn't get what they were after, and that we're grateful for that anyway, and we're sorry. I mean, some of them we obviously are saying good riddance to, and we wish you didn't run. But also there's others out there that we hope you'll come back and you'll stay involved and you'll run again. And to incumbents who didn't win, there are brighter and bigger things coming ahead. And thank you so much for your service, too. And
thank you, Cam, for bringing positivity to an otherwise vengeance-filled closing note here. Really great thoughts. I hope we see more of Katie Cashman in city, around city politics. I don't know where Jazz lives. You know, could he run someday against Linnea Palmisano? I think he'd be a really interesting candidate down there. Really interesting candidate. So, yeah.
And you can always move because you only have to live there 30 days before the election. As we saw this year,
You don't barely have to move at all. All right. Well, so we have, let's see if we have things to plug. I always plug Cam's Corner. Now that I'm down in Standish, I get the Nokomis Messenger delivered to my door with Cam's writings in it. Wow, all that's right. So cute. I don't have to go to the coffee shop to pick up Southside Pride anymore. But keep picking up Southside Pride. Of course, you can find us on the website, on our Instagram, Mill City Hall and millcityhall.com. Anybody else have anything else to plug?
Yeah, I have to plug that you and I, Jesse, have an art shanty in an art shanty project coming up in February. It's called The Table of Everything, and you'll have to come down to Lake Harriet to see what that means.
You think it'll be out on the ice this year?
We'll see.
But it'll be there either way.
Yeah.
Let's hope so. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. This has been Mill City Hall.